Welcome to the 40K Lorecast.
Welcome to 40K Lorecast with me, John Barsotti, and Brad Chester.
This guy.
And today, we're jumping into what I feel the most interesting and important element of the Eldar, the Aspect Warriors and their Phoenix Lords.
Yup, yup.
This is the lore, guys. If we talk about Eldar lore, this is where it gets real deep. So, as always, please leave a positive review in the cast and follow it. And again, the negative reviews are not appreciated. I'm kidding. If it was a negative review, join our Discord. Tell us what we got wrong. We do get stuff wrong, and I'm happy to own that. Please come in. Tell me about it.
And we'll fix it.
Yeah, I will literally fix it. It's also a great spot for anyone who wants to know, you know, more about the lore. It's a big, strong community in there that's actually, they're very engaged. They'll speak with you. You ask questions. You're looking for book recommendations, lore recommendations. It's all there. So please come join our Discord. It's a thing that gives us, as we said before, zero revenue, but I really enjoy it. So come on in. Also, for those of you who've been supporting the cast via Patreon, I want to start off and say a giant thank you. We are on new microphone rigs. We actually have some assistance with audio editing now, just on balancing some stuff out, which has been, I'm hoping you all appreciate a nice change there. That is only thanked because of the Patreon. So thank you guys for submitting it. If you want to be part of our Patreon, just like the Discord, the links are in the show notes. If you just click on the show, you'll see a link there for Discord and for Patreon. And for our website, the 40klorecast.com. Lastly, though, Brad. So for those of you who want to play the game on the tabletop, not just the lore, Brad is a 40K coach. So he's available for anything as simple as, hey, I don't know how this game is played. Can you tell me how to do it? All, you know, through, I've been playing the game for a little bit. I'd like to get better at it. Even I've got a tournament coming up. Can we just work on a few different ideas? All the way through, like, hey, I want to go win. I've been doing really well at tournaments, but I've never won one. Can you help me? Yeah.
I mean, any of that. One-offs, getting ready for certain things, or talking every week. I have all of everything and all of it in between.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on.
I know.
Let me tell people where you can find
Old Man Brad at 40K.
Old Man Brad 40K at gmail.com.
I was kind of trying to jump ahead of you, but I actually forgot what your email was.
As well as everyone does, but you can just go to our page and click on the link.
Yeah, click on the link and it's on the page. So on to the show. So as we covered in the last episode, the Eldar walk a path. Let's just say, you guys, it's a funny story. We just finished recording our last episode and only to discover that I never pressed record. I'm going to let you know the level of anger I have at myself is pretty high right now. And Brett and I discussed, we're not re-recording it yet. We're doing this one first. So anyway, that's a thing that happened. Hi, my name's John. I'm not great at this.
I love that it also happened 5 minutes ago.
Anyway, but we did open a new bottle of Montepulciano wine. We've moved the Miomi. We're still in, but don't get me wrong. The Miomi, we're still drinking the Miomi, but today we decided to do a little trip down Chianti Lane. So, all right, back to this. Eldar walk a path. Each of the paths is designed to help keep them away from the anarchy and depravity of the fall. Every path benefits the Eldar in one way or another. There's paths for artisans. There's paths for musicians. There's paths for scientists. But we're playing a tabletop war game.
A tabletop battle game.
Fair.
Rocking and rolling.
Yeah. So let's focus on the one that matters to that.
Path of the Warrior.
Yeah. Now, again, as we said last time, all Eldar, no matter the path, are trained in a level of war. They become the guardians, which are basically the militia of the Eldar. But that militia defeated Abaddon. So when we say an Eldar militia,
a pretty badass militia, though.
Yeah, that's on. But that's my
the best of the militia.
That's my point. When we say militia, we're not talking about a bunch of like weekend warriors who kind of get together and go out and do drills. We're talking about a militia that could take down Abaddon's crusade and did. So, just for comparisons, once an Eldar has chosen a path of a warrior, there are one of two things will happen. They will either do the path until they feel they've reached completion and they'll transfer to something else, like a warlock, or they will decide that this path is the only way for them and they want nothing more than perfection at it, at which point they will become what's called an Exarch, which is the most powerful of the Aspect Warriors.
That's not a Phineas Lord.
Yeah. So Exarchs, we would dive into this a little bit, is the term they use for them is they say that they have fallen into Kane's influence and they become a priest of Kane is what an Exarch is. And every Aspect has these.
Well, and the thing about them is while training in the shrines, this is what you do. These never let up. They train specifically into whatever their shrine is. Mm-hmm. So they're not learning. We're going to the different Aspect Warriors, but they're not learning any of the other Aspect Warriors is what they do.
They are the best at it. And they become this weird combination of like drill sergeant slash like super warrior because they're
super warrior, but they're also like the weird, not spiritual leader, but kind of their, because each, you have different, multiple shrines on all the different craft forms.
On the tabletop, it's actually easier to explain this via the tabletop. So on the tabletop, when you have an Aspect Warriors, the Exarch will actually have better weaponry than the rest of
and more wounds,
and oftentimes better ballistic skills sometimes even than the rest of them. So they've the Exarchs, like the sergeant in a Space Marine is kind of there.
These guys are like the embodiment of their shrine.
The knobs are a little bit better in orcs. I actually don't, I mean, this isn't me shitting on Tau. I just don't play Tau. I don't know if Tau have this. Do they have a sergeant? I actually don't know.
They do.
Does he matter?
No.
Okay, so there we go. But it's fine. And this isn't me shitting on Tau. This is just I realize I don't know that.
Shaz of Rey.
Yeah. So whereas the Exarch is more powerful. I have one. Quite a few games in 9th edition with my Exarchs being alive and the rest of the squad being dead.
In previous editions, some of the Exarchs for some of the units, you didn't even want the unit. You just wanted the Exarch.
Yeah. Swooping Ox. There we go. We both know where we're going on this one.
Like, there's an Exarch and I guess you four guys can come with.
Yeah, those four guys I only included on the list because I had to.
Yeah.
Didn't care about them at all.
I don't even give a shit. Yeah. I just need this dude.
Striking Scorpion too. That dude hit hard.
A lot of guys with sustained hits were bringing out.
Oh, and of course, what's it called? The Exarch for the Howling Banshees with the dual mirror swords, where it's like, oh, how many attacks does she get?
10.
All of them.
Anyway. 10 with rerolls.
Yeah. So the Exarch's fun little diatribe, but it's worth it. The Exarchs also wear a special suit of armor that can be upwards of 10,000 years old. That carries a special spirit stone in it. So every time an Exarch dies, if they put another person dons the armor, they actually gain all the knowledge of everyone else who's ever worn the armor.
It's a little lower powered than the Phoenix Lord armor.
Yeah, this is a good segue to something we're going to be covering later where, holy crap, can this concept power up to infinity? Exarchs? And again, as we said in the last cast that none of you heard, but we'll re-record it and do it again. Eldar are one of the few armies in the game where their tabletop and their lore line up really well for a short period of time before GW has to nerf the ever-living shit out of them.
Things like Exarchs, they can't be played on the board. The way they are, because a single Exarch would just murder half the board.
Let's call a spade here. There's been some rules we've had where they kind of did.
Look, with the Swooping Hawk Exarch, my most hits ever is 36. It's not that they
thank you. I was about to say,
so one guy got 36 hits. No big deal.
I think the Striking Scorpions one could at one point at least take down a Baby Knight single-handed.
Oh, easy.
Yeah.
Because he auto...
He auto wounded. Yeah.
And he hit on twos.
He hit on twos, auto wounded with an AP to like a billion. Anyway.
And he had explosions.
Yeah. It was. 9th edition was fun. Anyway. So Exarchs have kind of a very simple purpose. It's maintain the armory of the Aspect, which is called a shrine, and train, support, lead the other Aspect warriors. I mean,
they're senseis.
Yeah.
They're ultra powered senseis.
I like sensei. I like that a lot better. Yeah. They wage war. That's what they do, and they love it.
And they want to wage war, again, in the specific way that their shrine wages war. This is actually a big thing on this, because the we'll back it up to last week's. Yeah. But the Autarchs, the people that lead the Path of Command, take these different shrines and make them work together, because the shrines do not give a shit
about each other. Yeah.
Yes. About the overall plan. We do the thing we do.
Tell me when to go. That's what I do. When it's go time, but I'm also, the go time.
This is one of the big things about the elder, though, is we give them shit about a couple of things, but like they just believe.
Yeah.
Like so much in the way of their path that I don't need to know about what the hell you're doing. I do what I do in the Aspect Shrines.
The Aspect Shrines are, I really do love them. They are amazing because they are war perfected, but not war in total. We're going to pick one aspect of war and we are going to do it perfectly. All right. So with that, we have held Brad back long enough. We're going to do this in two parts. The first part we're going to dive into are all the aspects themselves, and then we're going to come back around for round two, where we're going to dive into the Phoenix Lords. We're going to do that because the Phoenix Lords themselves are actually easier to tell back to back to back, whereas if I did an aspect of the Phoenix Lord...
They interact with each other also.
That's why.
Some of the stories interact.
Exactly. I think if we were to do like an aspect with its Phoenix Lord, then do another aspect with Phoenix Lord, you guys would be trying to go like, wait, what were they saying 5 minutes ago or 6 minutes ago? So that's why we're separating it that way. Let's just list the aspects out so you guys understand them, and then we'll dive into them. First, we have Crimson Hunters. Brad hates airplanes. And I'll be honest, anyone who played the game in 8th edition also hates these airplanes.
Nothing like -4 to hit.
Crimson Hunters, they're one of the most, I would say, historically outside of Space Wolf, Invisible Wolves. Crimson Hunters are probably the top 5 most hated models 100%. Of all time. Yeah. Then we get Dark Reapers, who aren't that far off, who are good at ranged combat. Dire Avengers, who are close range shooting. Fire Dragons, who I joke, burn them with fire. That's what they do. Howling Banshees, who were kind of fast close combat, as opposed to Striking Scorpions, who are hard-hitting close combat.
You know, hold on, for our Tau people, the Striking Scorpions follow the Patient Hunter.
They do follow Patient Hunter, but they're actually good at it. Then you have Shining Spears, who are fast attack bikes. And lastly, what are actually my personal favorite, the Shadow Spectres, who are the most Forge World of Forge World. And I'll explain that in a little bit.
They also have a sketch pass, too.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I forgot Swooping Hawks and Warp Spiders. There we go.
Yeah, you should probably mention that.
In
things that are hated.
No. They're not as bad as Crimson Hunters.
No, but shooting and then leaving is...
Yeah, Warp Spiders have had some fun rules over the years. So Swooping Hawks. They've had some really fun rules over the years. Not for anybody else, but for the person. Yeah, I mean, the other person playing it. So let's start off with what is actually the original aspect and the bread and butter of the Aspect Warriors, Avengers.
And I don't want to put them down, but it's also the easiest to get in.
Yeah.
Because you went from Guardian to Dire Avenger, and it's the easiest of the...
Yeah, the Dire Avengers really are just, you know, done up Guardians.
They're more, you know, for the Eldar fans on that. They're more than that, but I'm saying it's the easiest to go to make the transition.
Yeah.
Because it's a skill that you have to have, period.
No matter what, exactly.
So you're just going to the next level. You got drawn by this path because you already had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, I don't know, Kof Kof, you're in Beeltan. They're just making you go there anyways. Yeah. Like, hey, man, I saw you shoot a gun. Why don't you shoot it for real?
Oh, you know, one other thing, it's funny, as I'm looking at the notes, I realized I didn't mention earlier, all the aspects have their own paint and color scheme. So whereas most armies, you don't have this, most armies you play in the game, you paint the whole army in your color scheme. In Eldar, you paint your kind of your standard Eldar within your color scheme, but then your Aspect Warrior is supposed to be their own color scheme.
And each shrine has their own color.
Yeah.
And each shrine has their own color that transfers over to no matter what craft world you're in.
Exactly, yeah. So if you're Ayend in Beeltan, whatever it is, you still do this. Personally, for those of you who are building an Eldar army, what I do is I just use the Aspect's key colors as the accent on my models, in my custom.
That's a good point, though. Make your shit your own, to be honest.
Yeah, do you. If you want to follow the narrative and paint it narrative, do it this way. But also if you're kind of like, well, hey, I had a cool color scheme for my army and I want to keep it that way. What I did is I have all my shoulder pauldrons and my, some like my helmets are done with the aspect. That's how I separate them out. But anyway, starting with Dire Avengers, their colors are dark blue and black with white highlights. That's, you know, so it's a blue army. Black pauldrons and usually some white because they wear a big crested helmet with a fancy mohawk.
I like that you just said big crested. They wear a gigantic gigantic helm that is almost as big as their body.
It's not as bad as it used to be. The plastic versions have come down quite a bit. Yeah,
it used to be all helm, no body.
Carandris?
Yeah. His helmet was this big and his body was a quarter inch.
So anyway, they carry a shuriken catapult, which shoots out razor sharp discs. Don't worry, everybody. I'm shitting on them in the next cast.
they're juiced up catapults, though.
Well, I'm just saying the shuriken I'm going to make fun of later.
Yeah, but it's one of the things is that they fire a better version of it that fires a little bit longer and it's a little bit deadlier. Yeah.
And so what the Iron Rangers are able to do is they also carry one of the more complex suits of armor. It's actually up there with a Space Marine armor, except that all the pieces actually work correct.
That is true. I was just saying.
So, for example, every
they still get poisoned.
Yeah, every Dire Avenger. Yeah, I think Eldar can get poisoned. Every Dire Avenger has a what they call a pan-spectral scanner, which I describe best as the thing Predator has, except it doesn't shoot, just kind of keeps track of things.
Well, the bigger thing on Dire Avengers, and they've had it over time, or they've done a decent job of it on the board, is Dire Avengers should be shooting Overwatch, which is when other things move or come into your zone. Mm-hmm. They do shoot it better, but it should be...
Yeah, they used to hit on fives, was it, or fours?
Well, now they hit on fives. They could have. They used to be able to...
Their original ballistics.
The original ballistics. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, they were horrifying in Overwatch, and they have a lot of shots. They also can fire at full speed. They've always been able to advance and shoot at no penalty. So, because that's what the Dire Avengers are supposed to do. The Dire Avengers' purpose on the tabletop is to kind of burst out of something, either from behind a wall or from inside of a wave serpent, which is a transport, and just put down this withering amount of firepower.
But be gone.
Yeah, that was not meant to not like covering fire. No, they came out and killed something and then disappeared again.
Just gone. They go behind a wall, back into the transport, back into whatever. And over the years, they've done a various degree of being able to continue to do that.
Yeah, and the thing about Dire Avengers is, like, the other thing too, to Brad's point about the Overwatch, they also are the kind of things you can't surprise them. So if they're sitting somewhere and you kind of come around the corner and yell, ha, surprise, you're already dead.
They're already...
Yeah, they knew you were coming. They're waiting for you.
So. And a lot of times, they're not as much in the thing, but in previous years and in the lore, they're often accompanied by Seers.
Yes.
So they might not be in the unit, but they kind of are in the unit.
They always worked really well with Seers. I mean, just the way, again, I think Eldar plays well tabletop versus lore. The way it would work on the tabletop is, they would just all hit. Yep. They would shoot and they would all hit and all wound. And it was like 30 shots.
And you've got the fact that they could put an Invuln on them with a psychic. You can make their save plus one more.
Yeah, they were nasty.
Yeah, I'm saying they did lots of things with this that they are one of the units that does a pretty decent job from lore to tabletop in several of the editions.
Mm-hmm. The next one we'll jump into are Dark Reapers. So Dark Reapers are, they wear black, where they're a little purple with white highlights, but they have skulls on their masks, which is interesting because the Eldar, the skull painted on their mask is not the same shape as an Eldar's head.
Yep.
But that's a side note. It's more like the Predator logo.
They're the heavy weapons teams, though.
Yeah. They use Reaper launchers, which are missile launchers that make AdMech salivate, is how I explained it. They don't need to reload their missile launchers, by the way. They just auto-reload, so they don't have to carry that. And they have anti-infantry and anti-armor missiles they can shoot at any time. And they're sniper-level accurate with these. Now, have they ever been a problem on the tabletop, Brad?
Jesus. Dark Reapers were bad for all of most of 10th until, like, right this second if you want some Interact.
I'm talking about 8th.
No, I'm saying this is why.
They got put in timeout.
In 8th edition, 40K, they were a problem because they could fire multiple times. The thing is that, yes, they were a problem. Probably when they were a problem, probably the most accurate to lore they've ever been.
Yes.
Because in lore, these are midnight warriors that are coming out shooting from devastating hails of fire from, they're almost snipers.
Yeah.
They're not, but they are. They're heavy weapons teams, but they come out and kill from a distance.
They destroy from a distance. I mean, they are.
But they barely pop out, too.
Yeah.
In the game, that's how you were playing them. But just that's what they do
they
in the
peek
game.
Peek out, destroy
something.
They're
not something. Just standing there like a Terminator squad going, mm-hmm. we can't be stopped. No, they're heavy weapons teams that kept peeking, you know, going where exactly where they're needed. Mm-hmm. But why they're so devastating and why I said even when they were a problem, they were very close to lore is because, again, Farseers, Warlock, yeah. you know, your different seers were telling them, you guys should set up shop right here.
God, our Yunari cast is going to be hilarious when we have to explain the Yunari lore and then why GW just had to drop it because...
Because it was broke.
Because, yeah.
Effectively, the lore wasn't broke. The lore was amazing. The
lore was amazing. Dark Reapers were double shooting. The Dark Reapers were shooting in the opponent's turn, not Overwatch. They were horrifying in that edition. But they were cool as shit. Now we'll do a quick hit from one Brad doesn't want us to talk about, which is Crimson Hunters. Because actually, in 8th edition, as bad as Dark Reapers were, these were worse. So the red planes, these are the airplanes. They're red. Their highlights are bone, like Wraithbone color, and black. Here's the truth on airplanes, guys. They were introduced in 6th edition, and I would say more than 50% of the player base wish they'd never been introduced to the game.
Flyers can go to hell.
Airplanes.
Flyers can go to hell. They can die.
Yeah.
The biggest thing about this is, again, you're taking someone and going, hey, I need you to figure out the best way to fly this craft. How long do I have? Let's say 500 years, yeah. and you figure it out. Weirdly enough, these guys can pull some maneuvers off.
Yeah. Well, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the next cast, but like jet bikers, but like Eldar don't really get affected by G forces. So their maneuverability that they pull out of,
well, their
out of
tech things just says
yeah.
no.
Yeah. Their maneuverability is insane.
The way they can do tabletop is they can completely go 180 yeah. on their planes and things of that nature. So these are just ridiculous. And they always have been since they came out. And while I don't like aircraft in the game, I love the idea of these guys just being Top Gun times 1,000 kind of people.
Oh, yeah. The lore of Crimson Hunters are awesome. The fact that in 8th edition, I could make them -4 to hit. These are the other stat guys.
This is stupid. By the way, that's -4 to hit when you're rolling 6s,
you're rolling 6s. Yeah, it's -4 to hit, and your ballistic skill's a 3. So you actually need to roll a 7 on a 6-sided dice to hit.
So stupid.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
It's time to accept it. The holidays are upon us, and finding gifts for people is never easy or really fun. Luckily, we at the 40K Lorecast have a new sponsor, which will help you make your holiday shopping fast and easy. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Add some personalization to your holiday shopping with Uncommon Goods. Did I go there and buy the game Fart Bingo? Yeah, I did. Is it for my child to play with his friends? We'll go with, yeah. At the same time, I was able to get a cocktail smoker. So yeah, those are probably all for me. Anyway, that's what's great about Uncommon Goods. They have uncommon, get it, collection of items you can choose from, allowing you to pick up a fun variety of items this holiday season. You'll find thousands of gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. So, shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/40klore, 40klore. That's uncommongoods.com/40klore for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
40K Lorecast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings may vary. Not available in all states or situations.
All right, let's dive into things that are actually, you know, more fun. I know Brad loves these. Fire dragons.
Fire dragons are boss mode.
Yeah.
Fire dragons are, one, orange, which is a color I can see, and I think it's sweet.
Yep. Or actually, they're actually red. But anyway.
Shut your face. They're orange, and I'm actually sticking with it.
They're actually red, Brad. They're red with orange and yellow highlights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's okay.
They're orange. And I love everything about it. And they've got a fusion gun, which is effectively, we did the
We did the Meltic Guest. Yeah.
We did the Imperium, the Guns of the Imperium. And a Fusion Gun is just a better Melta gun.
Yeah. They shoot Melta. They don't miss with their Melta. And their Melta actually hits harder than everyone else's Melta.
Well, they get all the bonuses because of the Seers, because of their combos. They're almost always just striking whatever they want to.
Yeah, and they've really embraced the Eldar perfection of aim. So the idea of a fire dragon shooting its fusion gun versus like a space marine firing a Melta gun is that the fire dragon will always shoot its fusion gun at the weakest point of the enemy's armor.
Cause the most destruction, and they know it, whether they know because of the Farseers guiding them or whether they know because of their training. But they know exactly where to shoot to cause the most damage, period.
And they actually carry something I love in the game, which are Melta Bombs.
They do just justice to Melta Bombs now.
Oh, they're useless now. But they used to be something where it was, because the Melta Bomb was kind of like a sci-fi action, like a C4 thing you'd slap on a tank and run away. But this is a Melta Bomb. It would explode with the power of a sun and would just destroy a vehicle. So they used to carry those. Their number one way of fighting is to jump, as a falcon would jump out of nowhere, and then out of the falcon would jump a bunch of fire dragons, and they would just eliminate forward armor.
Well, let's go into why that's so devastating. One of the things we haven't talked about in the Falcon is the fact that it has a rule called Deep Strike, which means that
it didn't always, though.
Right. Yeah. I'm saying now that it's super nasty, but it should have always.
Yeah.
Well, it used to have Sky Strike. Whatever. In the lore, these are spacecraft, which in the middle of a battle are plummeting down at breakneck speeds and then putting on the sky brakes because sci-fi.
Yeah.
And dumping guys out and immediately killing.
Yeah, and those guys come out shooting the power of the sun at the enemy. Yep. And then just, oh, look, that's all gone now. That worked.
Yeah. And in the game, in lore, they just load back up and roll out.
Yeah.
In the game, they're just.
And they've got one of the better Phoenix Lords.
Well, their Exarch is also amazing.
But the Phoenix of Fuegans. Fuegans,
banana pants.
Next, we'll jump into Swooping Hawks. They are light blue with white and green trim, and they have wings. I'll give GW credit. They actually wrote these wings correctly. If you read the codexes, it says on the wings, basically what look like feathers do actually vibrate, which creates lift. That's how they are. They are flying around, but they're not flapping their wings. For anyone who hasn't seen, what's Pete's last name? The comedian who plays Professor Xavier and he fires the X-Men.
Oh, Pete Holmes.
For those of you who haven't seen Pete Holmes on YouTube as Professor Xavier firing X-Men, go to the one where he fires Hawk.
Half of the people can fly.
And do other things. You're a bird. Anyway, so it's Swooping Hawks are... So the cool thing about them is that they're meant to do is not really necessarily destroy the enemy, but just harass and set up the next attack.
Well, the big thing is that not only they're harassing, their guns, the Last Talons, have a overwhelming a volume of fire.
Yeah.
They're putting out a hail of...
They fly over top of an opponent at breakneck speed.
Drop bombs.
And drop grenades on them. And shoot at them, which makes the opponent, the idea is it either freezes them in place or exposes them. And again, as a single unit, remember, as I said before, the Aspect Warriors are not deployed solo. They're part of an overall force, and each Aspect has a role to play. The Dire Avengers role is a bit more, if I'm being honest, take all comers. But, whereas we just discussed, Dark Reapers are kind of picking stuff off from afar. The Fire Dragons are coming in tight and blowing up armor. The Swooping Hawks are just there to jack up the enemy's infantry primarily, expose them,
and they've always had them. Sky Leap, which is their big rule, their ability, which is they drop their grenades, they shoot something up, and then they leave.
Yeah.
And then they rinse and repeat.
And you never know, in the lore, you never know where they're coming. Actually, tabletop too, to be honest. But you never know where they're coming from. You just know that they're there. And they basically slow, the idea is they slow an enemy down because they keep looking up at the sky, waiting for these things to jump out of it and jack with them.
Well, weirdly enough, they're one of the few Aspect Shrines, which just by the way that they're trained and the focus of them, is they are basically a buffer. They're a buffer Aspect Shrine. Sorry, Swooping Hawks, you do it great, but you are just a buff.
Yeah, if you were to bring 2,000 points of Swoop and Hawks, you probably might win because of weird rules. But yeah.
But I'm saying, like, the whole point of you is to expose, to harass, to sit there. That is what you do. You're helping out everybody else, because then the Fire Dragons shoot you, the Dark Reapers shoot you. You're basically exposing their position and or pinning them down, and then you're gone. Your whole point, I mean, the best way for a Swooping Hawk to be played and in the lore is not only did no one die, no one shot at you.
Yeah, that's the whole thing about them. And so I will say, I never saw them until 9th edition.
They were meh, except for the Exarch and the Swooping Hawks, and you can only take one.
But up until 9th edition, I don't think I ever saw them, because
it was just the old guy. The
Swooping Hawk, in 8th edition, you could bring him? Okay.
No, the Swooping Hawk Exarch, if you recall, is forever ago.
Yeah, I'm sure I remember when because they're a mainstay now.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm talking about the Swooping Hawk Exarch was 3rd, 4th edition.
Yeah.
So that's 24 or 5 years ago.
Was he good?
Oh, the Scrawl was terrible. He was good.
Yeah, there we go.
He had a power weapon with... with the unlimited sustained assault. So if you hit, you got another hit.
God damn it, that was so stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, Eldar are broken. It really is just fun to remind myself of how broken they've been over the years.
Oh, talk about broken. Warp Speeders.
Oh, yeah.
Arachnus Deathicus.
I personally love Warp Spiders. I love them from the lore. I love them from the tabletop. And I love them from the Dawn of War game. I am a fan of Warp Spiders in every facet I've ever seen them. And I understand, if you don't play Eldar, why you disagree with me.
No, I'm going to say, even for people that don't love the Warp Spiders, because there's a couple times, cough, cough, 7th and 8th, when they could do really abusive shit. Right now, I think they're actually good.
Yeah.
But Warp Spiders have always been great lore versus tabletop.
Yep.
Because Warp Spiders use warp jump generators.
Well, let's talk about what they look like, and then we'll go into there. So Warp Spiders, they're red and they're black with white trim, and they've got this really terrible pose that they've had since they came out. I'm going to be honest with everybody.
By the Russian model.
Yeah, Martel W makes their own version of it. That's what I run, because the regular ones look like shit.
Also, these guys are wearing some of the heaviest armor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Warp Spiders are cool as shit, because they actually wear this super heavy armor. Doesn't actually always translate in the rules, but it's a side note. But they're faster than every other one, except for maybe Swooping Hawks, because they also have a jump generator on
them. Warp jump generator.
Which means they go in and out of the warp instantly. So they do legitimately teleport around the battlefield.
In the warp.
And
they can lose people, and they've always had that, which I think is awesome, because you're just like, I'm going to take a warp jump in it with a Geller field. Are we making it? Are we trajectory it?
I think it's Dawn of War 2. The opening cinematic shows this really well, where these things just disappear and reappear and shoot at you. And it's like, they come out of, I mean, bonkers town, nowhere. But they also have a sick gun, which is the Death Spinner.
Is good now. Death Spinner does not do justice to what it is.
Oh, the Death Spinner itself is. So it's like there's a little bit of Spider-Man here, but it shoots a web, is what it calls it, of monofilament.
Monofilament web, which means that it goes between your molecules.
Yeah. It's the sharpest thing on Earth.
Yeah. And it cuts you in half. Yeah.
And what they actually do is even worse than that. Is it actually shoots out in a compact form. So as it comes out, it begins expanding. And that's designed so when it hits you, it expands out so that the monofilaments will find any hole in your armor and go through there. Or if you're just like a being, it'll just expand and just slice through you.
Slice through you. You just get diced up. You're like a charcuterie tray.
Yeah, it doesn't do that on the tabletop. But there's still actually really every aspect warrior. Yeah, all of them are good tabletop. It was cooler
when it used to be a wound on your initiative, because the whole point is you had to get the hell out of the way.
Yeah.
You couldn't just...
You couldn't take it.
You couldn't just take it because it just went cool, man, and sliced through you. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter what your armor was. And I love these guys in lore. If you're thinking of Eldar, well, this is Dark Eldar. My favorite's Mandrakes, but this is close.
Mandrakes.
When you're talking Warp Spiders, I love the fact that they're bouncing in and out of the warp. They're taking casualties here and there because they are making blind warp jumps.
Yeah.
Like legit.
They're doing them like, you know, 4 feet.
Yeah, on the tabletop, they're still doing quarter miles sometimes of these warp jumps, you know? So I just like the warp spiders. Lore on tabletop has always been pretty good. Yes, they've been some problems sometimes, annoyance with players. But man, like what they do in lore versus what's on the tabletop has always been pretty close.
True. Although I will say, if we're going to talk about annoyance, the next one we're going to cover, I can personally attest to irritating the living hell out of people with in 8th edition,
Shadow Spectres. By the way,
I love Shadow Spectres.
If you are going to get one unit of Eldar just to paint or just to have, Shadow Spectres, the model.
Yeah, but hold on that, because they could get legended. That's the only reason I tell everyone.
Who cares? They look good.
That's true. I just warn people, like, they're a Forge World model, which always means there's a chance
of them getting legended. Buy a 5-man squad of Shadow Spectres and just let them be awesome.
I think I have 15. So, just quick thing on Forge World. Forge World is a thing that used to exist within GW, where you could buy your models from Games Workshop, or you could buy your models from Forge World. Forge World was, they were both owned by GW as a parent company.
So weird.
Forge World models were 4 to 5 times the price, effectively, of GW models.
And they were either...
And their rules were insane.
You only had two options.
Yeah.
Terrible?
Yeah.
Or the most broken thing that's ever existed.
The thing that you're an idiot to not have in your army if you're trying to play competitively. That's what they were. And Shadow Spectres hit this to a T. So first off, their armor is white with blue and green trim. They're meant to look almost like ghosts is the best way to explain their look.
You mean maybe like a specter?
Yeah, they're specters. And we're going to dive into what these things are and why they were so broken. First off, they have my favorite Eldar weapon, which is Prism. I love Prism weapons. They had Prism rifles and hollow fields and jetpacks.
They are so... Wow, my God, they used to be so... They're still really good.
Oh, they're great now.
But I'm saying the old weapon, that the flamer auto hit you.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I have a good story for that.
Oh, yeah. But get to what I say. So let me tell you what it is first. The fire... So Prism rifles are kind of a mini laser las cannon, but they've got a focusing crystal that can turn it, that can change it. So it either is a focused, direct, powerful beam or a wide array beam. And in prior editions, the worst version of this was they had a direct beam that could wound a tank, I think on 4s.
Yeah, and they had a...
And then they had a like...
Auto hit destructor.
Or it was a flamer laser gun that was D6 auto hits that would F up a Marine. That got a little bit rough.
They're still good, but holy shit, they're insane.
Yeah, they also have hollow fields, which obscures them from sight. They used to be -1 to hit.
Well, they can also shoot and scoot.
Yeah, they shoot and scoot. And they had jetpacks. They could move, I think, 12 or 14. It might have even been 14 inches.
It's one of the few things in the game and in the lore. This, again, was one of the things that does set up with the lore and the game, because one of the biggest things about Shadow Spectres, and this is why Eldar has been so annoying for people to play against on the tabletop, is because a lot of their units, again, the way that Eldar does battle is, I'm here, and then I'm not.
Yeah.
Shadow Spectres did this all the time. Let me tell you the mechanic, even if you don't play 40K, Shadow Spectres would come down from somewhere else, shoot you, and then they get an extra move.
Yeah, and then they would move. So what you would do with them all the time is you'd bring them onto the board, they would shoot something they could see, and then they would disappear behind a wall where you couldn't see them anymore.
Which is 100% lore, but also on the board.
100% shitty.
Yeah. You're like, hey, man. Well, think about it. For multiple editions, Eldar has had the ability to go, I shot you. Okay, so I'm going to shoot you back. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
No. I'm not there anymore. You can shoot where I was, but I'm not there
anymore. There's nothing there. You're like, so 90% of your army shot me, but I don't get to shoot you at all? Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it works.
You having a good game so far?
You're making a face like you're not enjoying this game. I'm having a great time.
This seems amazing.
I actually, oh my God, it just reminded me of a game I played in 8th where I think I only lost 10% of my army.
Oh, the Shadow Spectre. Yeah. I do want to tell this because it's funny.
Yeah.
Adepticon, Mr. Jason Snigowski, and I are playing in a two-man, four-man tournament. You play two.
Yeah, two on two.
Two on two.
Great event, by the way. Super fun.
Cannot stress. Adepticon Team Tournament might be my favorite tournament in the world.
Yeah.
We are kind of splitting it up because it's, you know, one person, you know, in each half kind of doing our thing. Our opponents are coming at us crazy. We're losing a flank. And Snigs has a 10-man unit of Shadow Spectres.
Game's over.
I am setting up everything over here. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. All right, Snigs, this is what we're going to do. We're going to abandon this. You're going to hit him with an Overwatch, try to do some damage, you know, stall them. And then we're going to move over to the right. And I go back. And Snakes is just about to move his models. And I go, what happened? He's like, I just rolled only fives and sixes for number of shots. And I hit and wounded every time. And I killed everyone. Just literally everyone. Yeah. The member of the flank we were losing, they just all died.
Yeah.
And he's like, just everybody died.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we could probably just go this way now.
That's what Shadow Spectres
And that's what that's what I say when you thought, them. When you said Shadow Spectres are broken, I'm like, I've got one for you. Yeah.
And when I say I love Shadow Spectres, I love them because the model is cool as all hell looking.
Awesome.
The rules are lore specific to the best, the highest.
And they've
degree.
Always been.
They're very fun to play with. Yeah.
Well, they're even fun. They're very nice to play with right now, and they've toned them down quite a bit. Still,
they were so broken. Holy shit!
Oh, they were.
I had someone get mad at me when I saw I had them because Forge World models also used to be hard to get access to, and like I actually all my stuff's legitimate GW. So when I rolled up with
they were wildly expensive.
Yeah, I had quite a few of them, and it was anyway. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of Shadow Spectres, but I'll also be honest. I used to be a very big fan of Shining Spears.
You ruined my model. This only applies for people in the game because they made their bases much, much bigger.
Oh, they're useless now. Like they honestly, I actually would not play them anymore. But anyway, Shining Spears, they're a jet pack. They're a jet bike. I own 30 of them. I counted the other day. They are a white jet bike with blue and silver trim.
They look cool.
Yeah. The Shining Spears are the ultimate of the fast attack units of the Eldar. They are it's a jet bike with a twin shuriken catapult and what's called a laser lance, which is a lance, but it, at least unlike the stupid Adelan Rough Riders, it's on a jet bike, not a horse, and the lance shoots a high-powered laser out of it.
It's a tiny bright lance is what it is.
Yeah.
And the thing about this is they can put down a huge volume of shots. They have some heavy weapons because they're grav-mounted platforms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a jet bike, but it's a weapon platform.
It's an Eldar jet bike, yeah.
Right. So they have heavy weapons that they have in their squads, and they can also fight in close combat. Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the big things. We talked about the Exarchs a little bit before. This is one of the units where the Exarch is vastly superior to the rest of the unit.
The new version of the game does, but there have been entire editions of this game where you would, if someone had Shining Spears, your number one purpose was to kill them they would wreck you.
Well, this is a big thing. They would come in squads of three.
Yeah.
And the two guys were literally there to, I think that's my first one of the thing. Mm-hmm. This might be awesome. They were there to cheerleader.
Yeah.
I had, this is a real thing. Kramer did this. He had two Shining Spear guys that had pom-poms.
Yeah, just to support your Exarch.
Oh, Exarch, because he got a Star Lance.
Yeah, he had the Star Lance. Shining Spears in the lore, and this is why you're hearing Brad and I fanboy so hard on this part of this cast. In the lore, Shining Spears come out of absolutely nowhere, fire down. They will blast. They use their catapults and their lance to blast a hole in the enemy line, then shoot themselves into that hole and kill everything in there and then disappear.
Going hundreds of miles an hour.
Oh, they're like Mach 3.
Whatever that is in kilometers. Yeah. We're Americans. We don't know anything.
Yeah, but they hit you like a 1,000-pound hammer.
Yeah, they just show up going these ridiculous speeds and show up in a combat, and they're awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
in the lore, that's what they could just devastate an enemy. And the truth is, on the tabletop, they finally toned him down in 10th, but for 8th and 9th, they were a problem.
Bro, I always had at least two squads for the Exarch.
I ran a full 9-pack of them in 8th edition because they could do horrible things.
No, but just think about the oh, man. Exarch powers. We haven't even talked about it, but in the game,
they got rid of those, and yeah. I'm sad, but I get it. Yeah,
that was one of the things that translated. We talk about it all the time: lore mm-hmm. versus the tabletop. And I love when lore comes close. Sometimes it's broken.
Yeah,
but it's fun. I don't know. For me, it's a big deal that my tabletop feels like yeah. stories.
You know, I'm going to defend. We're pretty far into this cast. I'm going to defend the Eldar with this one. The Eldar get a really bad rap for having incredibly broken codexes. And the reason that happens is because they write rules. Shining Spears are one. Shadow Spectre is another one. Well, actually, Howling Banshees next. They've also had this problem where their tabletop rules match the lore. The issue with that is that other codexes didn't get it. It's not, that was the thing. It's not that the Eldar were broken. It's the fact the Eldar were the only one who were granted the luxury of having rules that matched their lore. So this is why I'm saying, I could run three packs of Shining Spears, an 8th and 9th edition, and just devastate an enemy with them, which is exactly what they would do in the lore. In the lore, 100%. Those little three packs would be all over the place, harassing enemy, shooting in, striking, killing a key character, debuffing a unit, all this stuff. That's exactly what they do in the lore. They did in the tabletop. No one else had that.
I miss Exarch powers.
Yeah.
GW, give me back my Exarch powers. I love having...
Give me back 9th edition.
But I like having customizability. We'll do a whole cast on that.
Love 9th edition.
Customizability is such a big deal for me. I don't want my army to be the same as your army.
I agree.
So...
And another one that's actually, so I actually like these. I've known a lot of people who don't. Howling Banshees. Part of it, I like the models a lot.
Now, they
were trash.
God damn it.
They were
trash. You know what? Screw this. I'm hijacking this one.
Let me just talk about who they are first, then I'll let you hijack. Okay. So
we'll be right back after a quick break.
They're an off-white with red and green trim with these big red hair.
They look cool
as all hell.
Poses are also awesome.
Yeah, poses are awesome. They got, well, their old models did not, but the new model they got, I think that was 8th edition. Yeah, it was 8th edition. The new models they got.
Jane Zarr's
kind. Yeah, the new models, the Jane Zarr is nuts good. So Howling Banshees were cool as shit. Go ahead, Brad.
Yoichi, Banshees were a staple. Matter of fact, I brought more Banshees in 8th and 9th edition than everybody else did.
Yeah, you were correct.
Everybody said... Most people said I was wrong, and I said, no.
No Overwatch.
Yes.
No Overwatch.
With also awesome Exarch powers.
Mm-hmm.
Banshees used to be awesome. And lore-wise, Banshees are super crazy fast, and they're acrobatic. They're anime. They're legitimately doing... If you are an anime-type person, you just need to own some Banshees. Because mm-hmm. they've been good in almost every edition. Well, except for 10. And
seventh,
sixth. If you weren't a fifth. No,
they're in sixth.
Maybe they did what they did in sixth, one unit.
Okay, fair enough.
Because you jumped them out.
That's true.
And they didn't have Overwatch. But the thing is that the ultimate anime, because they have rules like acrobatic. They're doing literal backflips and ninja moves and stabbing people and they're doing all the stuff that you're like, that's not physically possible. Banshees are doing all of those things.
Yeah, the Banshees are cool as hell because the couple of little rules they have is that they're called Howling Banshees because they're actually shrieking Banshees is what they should be called. They let out a wail when they come into combat.
They have a mask.
Yep.
A Banshee mask that disorients you by effectively giving you a sonic attack.
Yeah. And so what happens is in the lore, this is again, lore to tabletop, they nailed this. In the lore, this mask releases this horrible sound that disorients you and it allows them to kind of actually come from a pretty far distance till they're on top of you and now killing you with swords. In a tabletop, it turned off this thing called Overwatch. So for those of you who don't play the game, Overwatch is when an opponent says, hey, I'm going to make my models closer to your models. You get to shoot at me because I'm, you know, like you would do normal. Someone's charging at you and you're holding a gun, you shoot them. Banshees wouldn't let you do that. That is an insane power because they would just get on you. Lore tabletop, they nailed it. And then in combat, they'd have a ton of attacks because that's what they are. They're supposed to be acrobatic warriors.
And they also had defensive stats, but only in combat.
Yep.
Because they're supposed to be so fast, so elite. Mm-hmm. I'm making so many.
Brad's moving a lot for a recorded cast.
I am.
He does this on every cast, but on this one he's getting more animated today than normal.
So I'm doing so many.
I'm watching Brad do, like, shadow box while explaining stuff to you all.
If you
and by the way, if you've ever seen a Howling Banshee model and then you saw Brad,
I'm the opposite.
They are complete opposites of each other.
But I love the fact that they had an extra save. They've always had that in mm-hmm. combat because of the fact they're so fast. They're at, again,
minus one hit in combat, extra improved
they
save
used to
in
only
combat.
Have yeah. in, they, I mean, now everybody has an invuln,
yeah.
period, but they used to only have an invuln in combat.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big deal. In 10th edition, they suck so much.
Yeah, no, they're getting dusty. They're getting very dusty. So it's all right.
We'll move on.
They're paying
just,
for sins.
It makes me sad. It just, well.
All right, the last aspect we're going to talk about is one. Actually, Brad and I are going to disagree on this one a little bit. I know Brad likes them more than I do.
I love striking scorpions.
I'm not a huge fan of them, but I don't dislike them. I'm just not a huge fan of them.
Do you not like them because they change their fighting style from the first Phoenix Lord to the next Phoenix Lord?
I dislike them just because, yeah. It's funny. I actually liked some. I like their 8th edition rules more. But anyway, so striking scorpions are green for whatever reason, with black and gold trim, and they carry a chainsword and Mandy Blasters, which actually I do think Mandy Blasters
are
super cool.
Are like one
those
of
are
the
super
best
cool
things in the game.
Yeah, it's what they're super cool. So the chainsword, I think I've shit on enough, and the Eldar version is no different than the one I've taken a giant dump
smaller.
On.
Smaller,
yeah. But Mandy Blasters are really, really cool. We'll get into what Scorpion's doing in a second, but the Mandy Blasters are this like really weird. It's a face gun.
Yeah, they have. Well, it's very similar to what the Banshees do. The Banshees have a sonic attack. That's mm-hmm. what they do. Instead of the sonic attack, and if you look at the helmets, they're almost exactly the same.
Yeah, it's there. It, you can see it. These are red. Well, now they got new models, but on the resin models, you can see where the Mandy Blaster was. It was tubes on the side, on either side of the face mask.
But they shoot a very powerful monofilament attack
mm-hmm.
from their mask, which they wouldn't fire it until they were...
Yeah.
.0.
And this allows them to fight with their chain swords. They also had a pistol too, but they could fight with their chain sword. And so if you were to, you know, swing a chain sword and the opponent were to parry it, they could fire the Mandy Blasters out of their face and kill the opponent. Yeah. Striking Scorpions, whereas like the difference between Striking Scorpions and the Howling Banshees kind of come in fast, they're acrobatic, and they kill you. The Striking Scorpions were meant to be stalking. They would hide in the shadows.
They'd lay in wait.
Yeah. So in like, I actually think their rules in 8th were better. From a lore standpoint, because it was, if you were in cover, they got +1 to wound. Because the idea was that you thought you were safe, and out of nowhere popped these striking scorpions who get you from the shadows. Yep. They were shadow hunters.
And they weren't trying to. Howling Banshees will fight frontline units. Striking yeah. scorpions weren't trying to do that.
They literally lay in wait and come out of the shadows and get you. That was kind of what they were. I just liked that more. They were much better in 9th edition, but I liked them more in 8th edition.
I wasn't even close.
Yeah. All right. So that's that stuff. Let's dive into the Phoenix Lords.
Woot!
This is where Brad's gun. We're going to lose him. Anyway.
Fanboy so, like a madman. You know what?
Every aspect of the Eldar was at one point founded, which means that one person felt usually... Osterman's the unique one. We'll get him to a second. But they've usually been through the path of the warrior and then decide to specialize within the path of the warrior. So the Phoenix Lords all founded. Once they founded a new aspect, they then went to all the craft worlds and built shrines on each craft world to teach their style of combat. So that's that piece. The cooler piece of them is they end up with a very special suit of armor.
So the Exarch armor was a specific, by the way, Exarchs can become
yeah.
at the ultimate a Phoenix Lord. And effectively, the names of all the Phoenix Lords are just, they're almost criminal monikers. They're,
yeah, it's
your
Dread Pirate Roberts. And if you don't right. get that reference, watch The Princess Bride.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen The Princess Bride, turn us off right now and go watch The Princess Bride. It's better than us.
I'll say, true story. Yeah, by miles.
By miles. Like it's.
But the biggest thing in this is, there's a couple of things. If you've read the book Last of the Rentschi, things of that mm-hmm. nature, what happens is this armor houses all of the memories, and not the memories, the skills.
Yeah. And the spirit
Spirit
of that.
So all of this, I mean, and it's active. and sometimes it's overpowering. Mm-hmm. The actual minds of all the previous Phoenix Lords are in the armor of the Phoenix Lords.
Exactly. And so in this way, Phoenix Lords become effectively immortal. Because what a Phoenix Lord does is, if a Phoenix Lord is killed in combat, an Exarch, it actually doesn't necessarily even have to be an Exarch, just any Eldar.
It has been, but yes. It's supposed to be an Exarch.
But
it's not an Exarch, the shrine will be kind of pissy about
it. That's true. But if an Eldar then puts on the armor of the dead Phoenix Lord, the armor instantly reheals all wounds that it had, and that person ceases to exist, and they become the Phoenix Lord. And when I say that, I don't mean that like, oh, I've taken the name over. My mind is wiped, and I become
the Phoenix Lord.
Yeah.
You effectively get overpowered. Because
I just want to make sure it's clear that it's not like I'm taking on the moniker of Phoenix Lord. No. I am voice changes. Right. I am that Phoenix Lord.
Every Phoenix Lord, this is another thing which would be broken if they showed up what they were. Because every Phoenix Lord should be slightly better than the last Phoenix Lord.
Yeah.
Because you're taking all of the experiences. And the thing is, the armor gives you not just your experience, but actually all the skills, everything that you've worked on for however long you've been alive, you get all of that. And that is awesome in a way. I mean, it's terrifying because you get subsumed by 1,000 minds, which sounds insane, but...
Yeah, they're into it. As we know, quick side note, warp spiders don't have a Phoenix Lord. There's some rumors about that, but they currently do not and have not ever. It's been called out in the lore numerous times that there's because of where they come from. So anyway, but Brad's shaking. Let's go. We'll start with kind of the lamest of them, but also...
It's by far my least favorite.
Yeah, he's the lamest in the lore, but he's actually the most important was Oseram.
Yeah, because he started everything.
Yeah. So Oseram is...
He started the first shrine.
Well, he's the first of the Phoenix Lords. So Oseram, I think, tabletop, and I don't care that much, but his story's awesome. So Oseram was born on Lilith. God damn you, GW. God damn you and your namings. I'm from Philadelphia. Please don't put put two L's back to back. I don't know how to pronounce that. Anyway.
But Oseram was awesome because he starts off in the I should train and do things.
Well, let's start where he was. He was born on a planet that was within the Eye of Terror at the fall. So he was
literally part of the Eldar.
Yep.
Empire, what they considered the core of the Empire.
Exactly.
Which is the Eye Terror.
One of my favorite things about the Oseram in the story is he grew up around these murder cults. He wasn't part of them, but he just was like, he heard all the prophecies of doom, and he was like, it's probably not a big deal.
He was already kind of a hardcore dude. He's in the middle of all this nonsense, pleasure cults, all this stuff, and he just went, I'm going to go train Kung Fu in a mountain, basically. Yeah.
So anyway, the fall happens, and surprise, surprise, his entire planet is all demons now. This part of the story is a little bit weird. I guess he went and found shelter in this like old temple.
He went to a Tibetan monk temple.
But
that's the story, basically.
Right, but not like, it's hard to find. The demons actually couldn't get into it.
He was just right there.
Yeah, and he'd look out the window at demons, and he just lived there for a few years with the demons outside. No further detail given. But anyway, the story gets more important because he's all plot armor. Then one day.
Oh, really? Just because of the Star Child comes to him?
Yeah, exactly. Because he sits there and says, maybe this isn't for me, and decides he wants to go kill himself. And out of nowhere.
It's not like he was just like, I'm bored, I'm going to kill myself. His planet is destroyed.
Yeah, he's watching. I mean, he's surrounded by demons.
He also gets information of the fact that, the Eldar Empire, as I know it,
is gone. Yeah.
And I'm by myself in a temple, and I'm by the glory of nothing. I'm going to get smoked.
Yeah. So I decided to potentially commit suicide, which I'm then told not to by this child named Farathil.
Star child
named Farathil.
This is why
we're foreshadowing, guys. And you know me, I don't foreshadow. I'm foreshadowing 3 minutes. Give me 3 minutes here.
Also, he wears the biggest hat. Continue. Yeah.
So anyway, so Farathil convinces him not to kill himself, and he agrees not to. Then we randomly fast forward a little bit, And there's a Dark Eldar attack on the inside of the temple that they're hiding in. Again, I didn't write this. The demons can't get in, but the Dark Eldar can. Osserman wrecks all of the Dark Eldar. We also discover why they were coming for Firithil. The Dark Eldar were actually targeting Firithil, not Osserman.
They didn't even know Osserman was there.
Exactly. There's a reason why. We'll get to this in a second. Osserman just wrecks them. And now finds this gives him purpose.
Also, Osserman doesn't wreck them. Osserman laughably wrecks an entire raid by himself.
Oh, just so he solos. That's right. He solos a Drukhari raid.
It was a full raid.
Yeah.
He was by himself.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like, man, I snuck around and I barely won. No, he just kind of stood there and murdered everybody.
Shot each of them in the face. More like, yeah.
He ruins these.
Yeah, guys. This wasn't John Wick. This was Commando.
Yeah, he's just standing there in the middle of the lawn going, I was going to take cover, but I don't respect you.
Which also, if you haven't seen either John Wick or Commando.
Also watch.
Turn this off. Go watch that. So anyway, Osserman and Firithil and some other survivors who apparently were there randomly bail. And they start, apparently he could have left at any time.
Yeah, but he wanted to murder first.
But he wanted to hang out anyway. So they move around and eventually they settle on this world named Osser.
Also, Osserman settles on the word of Osser.
Yeah.
Also, super not worried about the fact that a random child appeared to him. Why would
this doesn't occur to him why this would be important in any way, shape, or form.
But this is a real story. Please read it. By the way, the story is actually kind of fun. It's just when you look at the facts of the story, they sound insane.
Oh, yeah. The Path of Osman is a good book, but it's when you write your cliff notes, you go, oh, God damn it.
Yeah. And you go, oh, like, that is actually what happened.
I was super into this book. I was all excited. And then afterwards, yeah. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, he just ignored that. He's like, oh, for sure. Of course there's a kid here. Yeah. Why wouldn't there be? Why wouldn't I just kill everyone I see?
Yeah. This
effortlessly?
Is
effortlessly.
So Osserman, after and his friends are settling on Osor, realize that the only path the Eldar have to salvation is through combat. They are going to have to fight.
Well, it's not just combat. Pause that. You know, I'm gonna throw it down on you, because just like if you watch the Kung Fu movies, which Brad has over the years, but I'm saying I got into Kung Fu movies in the 70s.
I was just saying, it's because you were born in the 70s.
So. By the way, early.
Yeah. Not 79.
No. So the biggest thing is that Osserman realizes that the only way the Eldar is going to push forward is with combat, but disciplined combat. Oh,
very, very true.
And this is a huge thing. This is like he says, in the Dark City, they're doing combat better than anybody else is.
Yeah.
But he said, we need to have discipline. Focus.
Yep.
This is when John Wick said, focus and will.
We need to be warriors, exactly. So they, on Osser, he builds, and this is important, Osser ends up becoming, as a planet, the first shrine, the first warrior shrine. He then goes on a little pilgrimage to all the craft worlds and telling them about his thoughts and this, and they'll be candid. The craft worlds are all in on this idea. And they say, hell yeah. And he starts building new shrines on every single craft world.
I'm going to give you the, to be fair, I'd probably be super into you going, Brad, we need to live a BJJ lifestyle. If I just saw 1,000 plus worlds instantly evaporated, and you're like, this will make it so it won't happen. I'd be like, you know what? This might not be true, but I'm in.
Yeah. Because of this, there are more shrines to Osserman there's more shrines to the Dire Avengers than any other by a wide margin. They're they are on every craft world.
Again, though, it's the easiest path to make the transition.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but this Osserman over time, this then becomes, as we get to the rest of the Phoenix Lords, we're going to talk about all started as Dire Avengers and then became Exarchs. And then eventually decided to create a new path within it. So Osserman is both the progenitor of all the Aspect Shrines, but also of all the Phoenix Lords. So that's Osserman. Kind of
biggest hat.
he does have the biggest of the hats.
His head is comically large.
It is a stupid model. Anyway, Osterman, just from a modern 40K standpoint, he's alive, although his miniature is older than probably most of you listening.
It's full metal, by the way.
It's full metal. I don't even think they made a resin version of it. I don't even know if it's for metal. I'm actually not even sure if it's still for sale. Like, I'm that
super heavy also. You could kill somebody with
it. Yeah, if you throw it across the room, people would be upset. Now, fun story on Osterman. He has returned to the lore very recently under the command of Jane Czar, which we're going to get to in a second.
That's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, we're about to, don't worry, we're going to get there. He has now pledged his allegiance to Yanid, which is a big thing in these Phoenix Lords as we go through. A lot of them have pledged recently their allegiance to Yanid and the God of Death. So, speaking of, Jane Czar. So, that little girl that saved Osterman from suicide, yeah, that's Jane Czar. You want more than that? Fine.
Settle down, Kung Fu Panda.
Yeah, all right. Jane Czar, the reason that the Drukhari were trying to attack and kill is because of who Jane Czar is. She was raised at something that was called a Hekatari, which are the precursor to the Drukhari witch cults. She was a child, and not even like Brad Scout Marine child soldier.
She's a child. But she's also like the chosen one.
Yeah, she was the greatest child pit fighter in the history of Kamara, effectively. This was what no one could stand with her. And she escaped, is what happened. At the birth of Slaanesh, she used that moment to escape. And she kind of jumped, I think, through a webway and found herself. And then Osterman was in front of her. Jane Czar, to Brad's point, is a star child. She is... She's the future of the Eldar race.
She's the chosen one.
Yeah, she is the future of the Eldar race. Jane Czar sticks.
She just showed up. Also, she's a little kid and she's a ninja, basically.
Oh, yeah.
She's deleting in arena combat trained, seasoned warriors, adult warriors.
Yeah, adult warriors. She's pulling down Talos. I mean, she was rough. It was cool as shit. But anyway. Jane Czar then finishes her training under Osterman and then realizes, yeah, I could do this also my way, and begins displaying. Because the way it works is you want to take the path of the warrior and you would look at these different options. And so Jane Czar was just kind of like with a stand outside of like the Dire Avengers shrine saying, want to do close combat? ? And people would say, I think I do. Show me more. And they'd see what she could do and they'd say, yes,
it'll
sign me up for this combat.
The sad part in the game is we don't get enough of this, but like in the lore, there's a lot of warriors that have went down multiple aspect shrines.
Yeah, we can't have that.
I know, because that guy would be T9 with 72 attacks.
We've already been broken.
Yeah. And four shuriken cannons.
Yeah, he'll have a gun on one side, a sword on the other, and combat 32 attacks and shoot. Yeah, exactly.
But there's some badass dudes.
Yeah. So Howling Banshees actually end up with the second most shrines to the Dire Avengers.
What's a big deal in this is I have to give the fact that Osterman started everything off. You have to give him props. And then he set up things. Jane Czar starts a shrine.
Yep.
But she also makes it a point to go craft world to craft world.
Yeah, she visits all her shrines.
Yes, and update them and say, this is we've just fought these war with blah, 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 the humans, the chaos, the whatever. Here's what we learned. And now we're doing this. Also, the Autarchs basically said, this helps them when we are this.
Yeah.
And they start to hone their, what is being a Howling Banshee mean? Yeah.
Jane Czar is also considered one of the biggest true believers in the Eldar. She really does believe both in the path of the warrior, but also in the reemergence of the Eldar.
She wants Eldar to be the dominant force, and not even in a bad way.
Yeah, not in a shitty way, not in a Beltan way. Yeah. In a like normal, like she really
wants
believes.
To be the light of the yeah. Actually, it is actually one of the cheesy lines in one of the books is she wants the Eldar to be the light of the galaxy.
And she got a great new model in the 8th edition, which is awesome. And
if you're going to buy one Eldar model.
Yeah. She is awesome as hell.
Or if you're going to buy one model, you can either buy Jane Czar, which is awesome as hell. Or you could buy Maghan Ra.
I hate the new Mugen Ram, to be honest, actually.
Whose new model is awesome and his old model is terrible.
Oh, I'm the opposite. I like his old
really,
model
Really? His little baby guy?
It was stupid, but the new model just looks weird to me. It's more that piece. The new model looks like a Shadow Specter to me. That's why I don't like it.
No, that's true. You're not wrong there.
Yeah. So anyway, but back to Jayne Zarr real quick. So we're going to do a whole cast on Yanari, and Jayne Zarr's kind of most of it. She has embraced Yanari hard.
She had some fights. She won some. She lost one.
She lost one, which we'll cover in the Yanari cast. But
it kind was of a pretty big loss.
It was a big loss. She may have got chopped in half and then more pieces. But she got resurrected, so it's not important. So Malgun Ra. Malgun Ra is the grumpy Phoenix Lord. So he was born before the fall.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is someone going to say someone's grumpy? I don't know. Maybe a guy that rode his craft world out of the Eye of Terror. Alton Saw, by the way.
Yeah, later.
Yeah, whatever. It still happened. Came out like Snake Plissken riding it out of it.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about that craft world in a second. So his craft world.
Shit that happened.
So Malgun Ra's craft world existed just outside of the Eye of Terror. So it didn't get eaten by Slaanesh.
But it also however, didn't make it out of the Eye of Terror. Yeah,
however, for some stupid reason, apparently the Eye of Terror has a gravity well, as we talked in the last cast-ish. But it actually got his... So everyone on the craft world, they weren't able to escape. I guess their webways didn't work and got pulled back into the Eye of Terror. Very slowly over, like... 500 years of descending into it, and at no point where they were able to figure out how to power out of there. So anyway, Malgun Ra somehow escapes this. They never explain how. He just does, and his craft world gets sucked in. No one else leaves with him, just Malgun Ra. Anyway, Malgun finds himself not in the Eye of Terror, joins the Path of Warrior. He was directly under Osserman.
Let's talk about this, though.
Yeah.
He's directly under Osserman, and like one day into training goes, this is stupid.
Yeah, this is stupid. Everything you're showing is dumb. Why are we using this? Basically, Malgun Ra's viewpoint was, yeah, everything you said is cute and lovely, but your guns are just not cool.
He's like, what happens if I took your gun and I put like 9 of them together and I welded them together and that becomes one gun? And I'll just shoot that instead.
And to his credit, the response was, well, you couldn't shoot that accurately. And he just went, hold my beer. Yeah. Like, boom. And Malgun Ra just decides to grab the biggest guns he can find and use them to just wreck shop at distance.
Also, he kind of went with the emo vibe and went, I know you guys are wearing all your bright colors and your big hats. How about if I wore all black with a skull
on me? Yeah. I mean,
and you're like,
do I have a Misfits tattoo?
Maybe. I guess you could do that. And he was like, yeah, we're doing that.
Yeah.
And also, I'm sorry, but Dark Reapers look about 100 times cooler than
Dark Reapers. I'm a big fan of Misfits. I like a good Crimson Ghost. You guys can give me what I'm looking for. So Malgun Ra is, by the way, like, and the Dark Reapers, they wreck shop when they show up. Abaddon's 13th Black Crusade, he just joined Eldred and demolished.
Well, let's talk about this. Malgun Ra and, in a very bigger sense, the Harlequins, when Malgun Ra and a group of his Dark Reapers show up at your craft world, you're just like, oh, cool, we got Malgun Ra here. Oh, man, we're about to get invaded.
Yeah.
Because, like, he only shows up when shit goes down.
Yeah, and it's going to get bad. But the good news is when you get invaded, if Malgun Ra's there, you're going to repel the invasion.
Oh, yeah.
He always wins. I mean, he is, but where this gets interesting, the story of Malgun Ra, that's actually kind of to bring us into the modern version, is that during Abaddon's 13th Crusade, while fighting, he somehow is able to see into the... It's actually right after Abaddon breaks the sky. He's able to look in and he sees that his craft world is still there. And his people are still there. So he and his buddies jump into the Immaterium. He
totally Lehman Russes
this. Goes into the Immaterium, jumps to his craft world, high fives as many as he can, and then just steers the craft
world. He just drives it right out.
Right out, which they should have done
10,000 years ago.
Exactly. But they come out of this. Where this is interesting, and this is one of those fun things where GW kind of gives you some question marks, is the rest of the Eldar are not thrilled to see them, because it's the, so you've been in the warp for 10,000 years.
It's actually more. But
potentially more. And
depending on what you feel about the timeline.
Yeah. And you're telling us you're not corrupted. Which is not helped by the fact that no member of his craft world will take their helmet off under any circumstance or speak above a whisper.
A whisper.
Yeah.
Like any, by the way, which doesn't even sound like a voice.
Yeah.
It sounds like basically sound coming from everywhere.
The Eldar are quite concerned about.
There's questions about Alten Saar.
Yeah, Alten Saar's got a lot of questions. But as we discussed earlier, also, Magomot did get a new model. It's fine. I don't personally like
it's
it. A lot
so
of people
cool.
do. It's,
come on.
I just, it looks, I don't, it's fine. I'm not a fan, but that's a personal thing. So let's jump on to a weird combo one, Baharoth.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Baharoth is actually, they think may be the first Exarch. The rumor is that Baharoth, it was the first Dire Avenger Exarch ever.
They made references to this, and I don't know.
It's just in the codexes. That's all I have.
They made a reference to the fact that whether he calls him his brother, as in his brother in arms, or if it's actually.
It's brother in arms. So yeah, the other thing too is he's referred to as the brother of Margon Ra. Yeah. He's not Margon Ra's actual brother.
Right.
It's just what they realized was in combat, this is the best combo.
Right. Well, I'm saying that. Yeah.
But Swooping Hawks.
He did make that clear though. Like in the beginning, you were just like.
It was actually it's true. Yeah, I had to read it four times, and I think the fourth edition codex to be like, oh, I see what they're saying. They were brothers the way the sun and the moon is how they just used to, is how they wrote it. Right. So the idea is that they don't really work without each other, but they're not actually related. So, and it's a cool thing because the idea was from a combat standpoint is Baharoth and his Swooping Hawks would just lightning strike in and jack up an enemy and mess up their position. And then Morgan and his buddies would just destroy them now that they couldn't move.
And the thing is that. In the original lore and rules, Baharoth used to be way more of a close combat threat than he was anything else.
And that's changed because Jane's are. Yeah. I mean, that was a bit because Baharoth is written in the codexes as the fastest and most agile of the Phoenix Lords.
I love that your notes are suck at Jane's are.
Yeah, because that's what it's like. Just wait a minute. Jane's are is supposed to be that. No, Baharoth is faster. Oh, so he can use close combat? I mean, technically, he just chooses not to. There's actually not a lot of lore on Baharoth, unfortunately. I wish I could cover more about it, but there's not that much. It's just kind of, this is who he is. It's not a lot of key stories that involve him.
Yeah, he shows up a little bit in the Yunari storyline.
That's it. Yeah, I'd say modernly, he's part of the team under Jayne Zarr fighting for Yunnade. He also has one of the oldest models in the game, him and Osserman.
Oh, you have to get the alternate.
Yeah, again, Artel W. You're going to, like, so. I'll just call it out. Artel W is a company out of, I don't know if it's Russia or where.
You're never going to get sponsored by GW.
It's fine, whatever. But anyway, Artel has a great Orc and Eldar line, which is why I like them so much. They're really good at both of those. Ooh, they also have really good Arbites too, if you're looking down that path. But although GW Arbites are still good, so it's not as big of a deal. It's just, my viewpoint is I'll buy GW unless it's resin or pewter, in which case I'm looking around for other options. Let's dive into Brad's buddy, Fuegan.
Hell yeah. I love him. He also can come back to life. He's Phoenix Lord of the Fire Dragons. He's a badass, by the way.
Fuegan's viewpoint is where Morgan Ra's thing is, I'm just going to shoot from really far away and blow stuff up. Fuegan's viewpoint is, I'm going to make something not exist anymore.
Which is weird for me because his teachings and how he fights are two different things.
Yeah.
Because he teaches you, he wants to come up personal, destroy what it is, kind of make sure it's destroyed.
He destroys absolutely.
One of the reasons in a couple of the snippets that you get from him is that he wants to make sure something is gone.
Yeah.
There's too many stories of random big baddie being hurt and crawling off later. He's like, I don't want any of that to happen.
Yeah, no, all of them are dead.
But
today,
one of the biggest things about him is, even though he doesn't teach it in his shrine, he will melee the shit out of you.
Oh, yeah. Fuegan, it's funny because I do laugh at Fuegan. Fuegan is the head of the Fire Dragons, who are a like Melta-powered unit. Fuegan in close combat is a powerhouse.
And in stories and multiple rules, he used to get better when he was hurt.
Yeah, Fuegan's cool as hell. Now, there's actually not a lot of lore on Fuegan because he actually was lost to the Eldar for a while. One of the Phoenix Lords turns to chaos.
What?
Yeah, we're getting there, obviously. And this actually, Fuegan gets consumed by it and ends up just jumping into the webway to travel the webway looking for kind of asses to kick, for lack of a better phrase.
And he, and that's the thing, is he melees the shit out of
people. He will randomly, it's a, in the lore, all Fuegan really does in the lore for a long time is he just appears randomly at a battle and just kind of plot armors the situation. Saves the Eldar, beats the crap out of an opponent. Yeah, that's his thing. Now, the other key thing about Fuegan is, I know you don't like
Ranadandra. I love Eldar so much, but...
So there is a thing in Eldar called Ranadandra.
Ragnarok?
Yeah, Ranadandra is Ragnarok. They're not even trying here. Ranadandra is supposed to be the final battle between the forces of evil and the forces of good. And at the end of it, the Immaterium and the Materium will both be destroyed. For those people who've been playing GW games for a while, this is actually what GW did to Warhammer Fantasy.
That's why we have AOS.
Yeah, so they actually did. GW did kill.
The only evil guy to win in a GW game. Archaon.
And actually, GW
blew up the world.
Well, I mean, GW sent out effectively a press release to all of their players saying, hey, the game doesn't exist anymore.
Yep.
Anyway, Fuegan's critical in Ranadandra because apparently the battle commences when he brings together all the Phoenix Warrior Lords and their warriors to a final battle with Chaos. And it's actually as Fuegan dies in the final battle that the universe will come to an end. Good news is now he's fighting under Yanid.
And he's going to fight the Midgard serpent.
Yeah. It's.
I love everything about Fuegan until.
Ranadandra.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just. It's lame. All right. Let's jump to one of my favorite. To one of the ones who's also
I'll let you do this because this is a.
I can't pronounce it. Earlieth. Earlieth. Earlieth.
Shadow Spectre.
Shadow Spectre Phoenix. Again, I can't do two L's, guys. I'm sorry. I can't do two L's back to back. I just can't.
Also, wow, and the game has varied wildly in power.
Yeah. Earlieth is the Shadow Spectre Phoenix Lord who rose again under Osserman and then decided that, well, what if I could be fast and stealthy with incredible firepower? And everyone went like, yeah, that's kind of all the things you'd want to be. And he went, cool, got it, and does it. So that's kind of where Broken Ass Forge World. But again, ends up, Forge World does a weird thing. Just like Death Corps of Krieg, they write really good lore. Really, really good lore. So Illrith, since kind of birth, had this vision of his home planet, actually his home craft world being destroyed at the hands of this like reptilian race. Yeah, from an unknown planet. And he's just obsesses over this for years, but he's on the path of the warrior. So he's got to fight. One point, Illrith kills a greater demon of Slaanesh single-handedly.
Yes, but this is the lamest shit on this. So awesome.
Yeah.
By the way, killing a greater demon, killing Keeper Secrets is amazing. And then he was like, hey, and the Keeper Secrets went, check this out. This is what's going to happen to your home world. He was like, there's no way a demon would lie to me. Let's go take care of it.
Well, it might have been true, but...
Because demons are totally known to be super truthful.
Fair enough. So he kills a greater demon and discovers the planet that this reptilian race that's going to kill his craft world comes from. Remember, this is Eldar. So Eldar love killing something 10,000 years before it's a problem. Illrith goes to the seers of his craft world and says, hey, I found it. We have to kill them. And they all went, yeah, okay, go ahead. So they send Illrith out. Because
they all went, hey, again, looking to the future, when we say sometimes it's questionable what they choose. He said, I learned this knowledge from a demon that I killed that said that this was for sure the truth because I would never lie to you, bud. Those were pals.
Mm-hmm. And
this is so stupid.
It's just dumb. But the story gets dumber, which is why I had to tell it. So Ilrith and a bunch of the other Aspect Warriors go to this planet and they engage in a battle. And the only thing I can think of is if you've seen Monty Python, The Life of Brian, when the People's Front of Judea, the Judean People's Front meet under the tunnels and then actually just kill each other. And then the last guys die as they stab each other. That apparently is what happens, because Ilrith and every single one of his brethren end up dead, but so does everything on the planet. Anyway, you're thinking, why is that story? That's very interesting, because it gets funnier. Fast forward thousands of years, because Ilrith's body's just in some cave on some planet. Somehow, the Eldar discover that he's in a cave on this planet. They also discover that the Imperium has built a colony on the planet. And they decide to do the only thing should do.
This is your top notch.
Eldar doing notes. Eldar.
No, yeah. I'm saying the notes on this are exactly what happens, but it's also amazing.
Yeah. In classic Eldar fashion, they sent an emissary to go negotiate the return of the armor. No, they didn't. They just attacked out of nowhere with no warning.
No warning, no idea why you're attacking.
Yeah. Just killed everyone on the planet, threw an Exarch on the armor, brought Ilrith back, and then left.
Deuced out. And then you're like, I don't understand why the Imperium's always dicks to us.
Yeah, it's like weird. Well, like, you could have just called.
Yeah, we would have literally handed you the armor.
Yeah, nope.
Also, it was a totally unprepared for combat
world. Oh, yeah, it was a mining world that was just like, that got a full-blown assault from a craft world. Yeah, it's just
like. You were just sitting in a lawn chair, and you're like. Yeah.
What? The only thing that's funny to me is I firmly believe when these kinds of things happen, the Imperium, because what you would do is like if the Eldar smoke a world, they're like, well, what was the reason? They're trying to look at all these reasons for it. It's like, oh, there was just something there they could have asked us for. And they chose.
So we would have just like been like, it's right there.
Right there. It's of no value to us. Go ahead and grab it.
We also didn't even know it was there.
All right. Now we'll do a super quick hit. Amon Harkat. He's the Phoenix Lord of the Airplanes.
Yeah, you should probably.
That's all there is written on him. Nothing. No story, no nothing, just they gave them a Phoenix Lord.
It's literally a blurb in a codex next to the plane.
Yeah, and that's it. Yeah. So there we go. Second to last one we're going to do, or third to last one, however you want to look at it, is Drastanta. So Drastanta is the Shining Spear Phoenix Lord, or was. This is one of the few ones who is still currently dead. So Drastanta is a little bit of a jackass, and by a little bit, I mean a pretty serious jackass.
Well, he was a Samhain guy, so.
That's why. And Drastanta was raised under Osterman, but he just got obsessed with battlefield honor.
It wasn't even battlefield honor. It was battlefield glory.
Better one. Better way
of honor playing. Is something different.
Yeah.
He wanted to show how awesome.
I am the greatest there ever was. Period. Yeah. And he loved, like, again, finishing blow enemies. It was just this whole thing.
In a couple of the short stories, he gets people killed because he let people hang out too long. And he didn't get killed several times, but like other people did.
Even members of his own aspect got killed a lot because instead of just finishing the battle, he tried to extend it a little bit longer for some more glory. So he sucked. Luckily, he's dead. So anyway, he dies because, and we're getting there in like 1 minute, guys, the demons invaded Osir. So that planet where Osirman founded the very first shrine on, and Drastanta found himself, like, he was one of the ones fighting there. Osirman dies in this battle. We're getting there. And Drastanta just freaks out and attacks a keeper of secrets.
Inkari.
Yeah, Inkari. He does kill Inkari single-handedly.
Whoa. He got off his bike.
Yeah, that's right. He got off his bike.
Soloed
a
keeper of secrets.
Walked over to a keeper of secrets, which he's mildly looking up at, holding his lance, and jacks up Inkari. But at the end of jack up Inkari, he's just disappeared. His celestial lance is just lying there, and Drastanta is gone. No one knows where he is, but the celestial lance is now utilized by Exarchs. But he's the only. But we don't know where he is.
Yeah, we haven't had a Phoenix Lord for the Shining Spears since then.
Yeah, and so will he come back? Likely. So anyway, we've teased this enough. Arhra.
The original Striking Scorpions Phoenix Lord.
I can't pronounce any of this stuff. All right. So our Hara was Discipline of Osserman, but he's a little bit weird. Actually, you know what? It's a good comparison to Conrad Cruz. Our Hara was the head of the Striking Scorpions. The Striking Scorpions are, as we said before, they strike from the shadows. They stalk their prey. They come out of nowhere.
This is not. They changed this. Or, sorry.
It's where they were.
Where they were. I'm saying this is from the beginning of the original Phoenix Flood.
Yep.
Now, K'Ron is now a patient wait for everything.
Yeah.
Originally, they were... We'll sneak up, boom.
Yeah, they were forward deploy, sneak crush. In there, come out of the shadows and kill. Like Mogon, he really wasn't, he's not a big fair fight guy. You know, where we just talked about Drashtanta, who loved the honor of combat. Ahura liked killing. That's what
he did.
And probably a little bit beyond. And by probably meaning definitely. Ahura ended up, I'm going to keep probably like pronouncing this different every time I say it. I'm sorry. I can't pronounce some of the letter combos that GW chose. It's just me. But Ahura began to kind of thirst for more and more murder and killing. So, yeah, he kind of was a Drukhari as an Eldar, but also a key part of the fall. This begins to kind of pull at his soul a little bit. And I actually couldn't find it anywhere, so people are welcome to tell me in Discord how it happened. But effectively, at some point, Ahura allows the demons access to Asuria, so the very first shrine.
Well, it said...
Because he never gives his soul to Chaos.
No, but he says he's corrupted, but I think that he also wants to battle them, because he gets so crazy about it.
Is that what it is? I could not remember how this happened, and I couldn't find it. I didn't feel like reading it. Well,
it's a big thing on this because he felt like no one was testing him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I can't be stopped kind of thing. And we don't do enough murder battle.
Yeah, he was upset. Sorry, I forgot about it. He was upset about the fact that when they would duel, it was, you know, to win. It wasn't to death.
Right.
And he wanted to go to death. He was psychotic crazy.
Always wanted to kill everyone and also just wanted to murder. Talk about people that didn't like anybody that wasn't Eldar. He didn't even like Eldar, but also he wanted to just go, why don't we just slaughter everyone?
No. And kill everything at all times. And he took massive joy in the murder and the slaughter. So, again, at some point, he decides through corruption or whatever it is to open the Immaterium on Asuria, which demons pour out. And this becomes one of the greatest battles the Phoenix Lords have to wage, because it's Osserman, it's Drashtanta. I believe Jane was there. They're all there fighting. And Osserman gets killed by a Phoenix Lord. And Osseria is lost at this point. They end up having to retreat from Osseria. Ahura, I cannot do that damn name, jumps into the webway and goes to Kamra. And then becomes Drazar. Although, technically, from a writing standpoint, we're not 100%.
It's 100% Drazar.
I know.
But the thing is that he's now... Drazar is effectively hatred in armor.
Yeah.
There is no more Ahura.
Yeah.
There is just Drazar.
And he founds an aspect.
What Drazar actually... Drazar isn't even a real name. Drazar just means living sword.
Yep.
Drazar... I don't even know where it happened, because Arya eventually gets killed.
Yeah, killed, and his armor resurrects as Drazar.
Yeah, and then Drazar becomes basically an evil version of all the Phoenix Lords.
Yeah, he founds an aspect in Kamara to create, and they become incubi. So they are the evil version. I mean, it's funny because we talk about Drukhari. Drukhari are not, they're evil Eldar. But these ones are the evil Eldar, like the, you know, Brad and I are old enough to where you'd have the evil clone would come out and he would have a mustache.
Yeah.
That is what Drazar and the Incubi are, you know, to the Phoenix Lords and the Aspect Warriors. They are an evil version of an Aspect Warrior.
And the thing is that he walked in to this and just, they made it and came up and just, you don't, they do this up different, because like originally Arius came in and made this shrine. And then Drazar came later. So at some point in time, Arya dies.
Yeah, it gets really... GW, actually, it's kind of cool here. They made it so that you're 100% certain that Arya is Drazar. except he might not be.
Right.
Like you also know that you could be told wrong that he's not.
Yeah, but because at some point in time, Drazar shows up at the Incubi Temple and murder faces everyone, has never taken off his armor, hasn't spoken to anybody, and just shows up when it's time.
Drazar also really doesn't like Phoenix Lords.
And yes.
So I will say, when we'll cover this more in the Drukhari cast, but the Drukhari have an alternative history here about how Drazar actually, or Arya, was actually the only Phoenix Lord to really understand the true needs of the Eldar and felt that combat was the thing that mattered more than anything. And the demon thing wasn't even his fault. He was fighting the demons the whole time and blah, 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 blah. We'll get there later. But it's kind of, I do like that the Drukhari have an alternative history here. But when Arya moves to Chaos, the Striking Scorpions don't stop existing.
Existing, yeah.
They promote their greatest Exarch, who is Corandras, to be the Exarch of...
And this is why I'm a big Kharon fan. So yeah. Corandras doesn't get all the knowledge of thousands of years.
No, he does it himself.
Yep. Corandras just goes, I guess we're going to do what I do.
Well, he was also Arya's number one student. So he wasn't just a random...
So he's Exarched up, so he has Exarch knowledge of previous Exarchs.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have Phoenix Lord.
Right. But what I like is that you point out earlier is that he also decides that the way the Striking Scorpions are waging combat wasn't beneficial. Being a forward deploying slaughterer actually carries with it a lot of casualties. What will be is the patient hunter. We will stalk the shadows of our opponents and we'll wait until they're exposed, kill them and jump back into the shadows. Exactly. So they end up, they go from this kind of like, you know, Night Lord-esque forward deploy slaughter thing that just kind of, I guess it works, to this incredible precision battlefield. I'll make it. And it became a battlefield scalpel that would just be the idea of a Striking Scorpion. The way they should play is if you've got a rear deployed unit, the Striking Scorpions would just appear and kill that rear deployed unit.
And just take off.
Yeah, and disappear again. That's where they're amazing. And so Corandras in the lore is written to be, he's not the warrior that Drazar is. There's no question there, but he's more intelligent. And we saw that because they do meet and fight. Corandras and Arad, who is now Drazar, get into a battle. Corandras knows he's never going to win this in a million years.
He lures him in, gets him going in a murderous rampage, and then him and the surviving Striking Scorpions smoke bomb out and leave, and Drazar just kills all the Incubi.
Yeah, Drazar loses his mind over the battle, ends up killing all of his own soldiers. Because he wants
to kill Corandras, and now Corandras isn't there. He's like, well, somebody's getting killed. Yeah. And it's going to be you.
And so that's where they've kind of put Corandras. I think from a lore standpoint, they did a good job with that because you couldn't say that, oh, Corandras took over from the prior Phoenix Lord and was just as powerful. He's not as powerful as a prior Phoenix Lord, but he knows how to exploit the prior Phoenix Lord. The last little bit we'll talk about Corandras is Corandras has also joined Jaehn-Zarr into Yneed. So I think it's everyone but Maugan-Ra is under Yneed right now.
Maugan-Ra is just doing Maugan-Ra.
Which is ironic because if you played Yennara, you actually used Maugan-Ra. He's not a great person more than any of the other ones. But
we have to wait to talk about why.
It's fine. Anyway, I will say
some people fought, some people died, and some other people fought and some people died.
I will also say on the Corandras note, the model sucks. It's actually worse than the Osterman model, the GW version.
It is less than an inch tall.
It is, and well, no, the body is less than an inch tall, isn't it? But the helmet goes.
The helmet's huge.
The helmet adds an extra 3 inches to it. It's a horrible model. Artel W, the one I have, looks like the Predator. It's way cooler. Anyway,
than just a giant hat with tiny legs.
The giant hat with tiny legs. So, all right, with that, we're going to conclude this one. Next week, we're going to do our fourth cast on Eldar. Where this one, we're going to dive into just kind of the weapon. We had to cover the Eldar weaponry. So it's going to do stuff like, what is Shuriken? What is Prism? What are D-cannons? Wraiths, Falcons, all these types of jet bikes, those types of things for the Eldar. And some of the key elements of Eldar lore, to kind of catch everyone up. So with that, this is John Barsotti and Brad Chester.
This guy.
See you next week.